Today is Thursday. It's July 15th, 2021. It's 1:48 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
Hi, I'm John Hanson of Block Club Chicago and filling in at WGN Radio.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Brandon Pope, president of the NABJ Chicago chapter and reporter and anchor at WCIU.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the unaffiliated pundit.
I wondered how you were going to slate yourself there, Mr. Z. You going to go with that one?
I don't know what I'm going to go with, though. We have to see where this all develops, but I'm certainly taking July off. So,
are you still in Michigan right now, Eric?
No, I was in Michigan last week, which is why my laptop battery died on me and I disappeared from the show right toward the end. But no, I'm back in Chicago now.
We're all looking at each other on a Zoom screen, and Eric has as his backdrop what looks like a ship's deck with some old people playing some sort of shuffleboard game.
I'm working on my retirement shuffleboard game. Yeah. I hope to excel.
Is that the corner picture? Are you right there? Is that your form? I guess that's good form. I wouldn't know.
Well, when I go to shuffleboard camp, I think I'll find out what good form is.
So. Yeah, you're in a position to take the coolest journalism job title, which is editor at large. I love when people are something at large.
That's nice.
I'm going to be using that from now on, Austin. Thank you.
Podcaster at large, etc. SROs in Chicago are school resource officers, Chicago policemen and women who patrol the schools. This week, the schools in Chicago had to decide if they want their SROs or not. And not just do they want them, but do they want to continue to pay for the Chicago Police Department officers for them? $50,000 a year per SRO. So some schools, without counselors or art teachers, have been canceling their cops and spending the money in other ways. I think this is a terrible position for CPS principals to be in. The city or CPD should fund those positions. Guys, how is working in a school any different than working in a neighborhood? I was a little surprised to discover the economics of this. And while I hate to see the cops leave the schools, which unto itself is debatable, maybe they shouldn't be there in some capacities, but I'm really sorry to see that they have to fund them or make that decision. Do we want a full-time therapist and counselor in the school or whatever, or do we want officer-friendly?
The problem is that you're dealing with an SRO system managed by the CPD and CPS that's been horribly mismanaged for a long time. So it's not always officer-friendly. These people lack a lot of training to work in schools. Sometimes they're just thrown into a school environment and they still have their policing hat on. And that's a recipe for disaster in a lot of these schools. I do think it's really good that local schools have the control and can vote where to put their resources, because some of them may not find a need for someone full-time serving that role, and they would prefer to use the resources elsewhere. And it's a tough decision to have to budget for that, but that's what budgeting is. You have to make choices about what you want to prioritize.
Well, Isn't it also the case that the school communities themselves make this choice, that their local school councils will vote? And there was at least one school, maybe it was Jones, where they voted to keep the officer 1 year, and then just recently they voted to get rid of the officer. It does put the schools into a really awkward position. And one thing that I've noticed, I was looking at the list of schools, and it's not a hard and fast rule, but there seems to be, like when you have schools like Von Steuben, Lakeview on the north side, Jones, which is a selective enrollment school, some of these schools that have kids with maybe a little more privilege, that they are getting rid of their officers. And then you've got schools in rougher neighborhoods where the crime is a bigger problem, where the community does not want to get rid of the officers. And so, and yet at the same time, the accusation against these officers is that they, as Austin said, they're not always officer friendly, and that they tend to get these young students into the criminal justice system much earlier than they should be. And so you want a different kind of discipline. You don't want the police enforcing the rules in the school. You want social workers. You want maybe security guards, something like that. It just seems like a really tough position to put schools into, and that you're making a decision. The school community is making a decision that probably ought to be made by the Board of Education and by the Chicago Police Department, where they feel that they really need to put these resources, and not these parents who are understandably pulled a bunch of different ways.
If you have a community of 800 students in a school, that's a beat. That's an area that the police would police, I would think.
That's great if there actually are positive relationships. And I think some of the concern people have had is that it creates maybe a culture of fear. Maybe it creates too many scenarios where something bad could happen. I mean, I went to a school near the border of Ohio, Indiana, where we had two school resource officers, and I got along with them great. I didn't like most cops in the community, but I love these two guys. We'd go kick it. If you're a good school resource officer, you're establishing those relationships. You're serving in a mentorship role, in a sense, not just a security cop role, right? Making sure these kids make good life decisions, understanding they're young and they're going to make mistakes, and allowing thoughtful, ethical, restorative kind of punishment when you can. I think that is the real concern, the system itself. Now, like you said, these schools are in a tough position now, but it's like they're taking them all away, and I'm not sure you need to go all the way, take them out altogether, but maybe you just got to look at the system and make sure that these relationships are actually healthy and that students feel like this resource officer truly is a resource to them and not someone that's just kind of a deterrent or someone they should be fearing. A lot of them have guns. That's not normal. I think it's interesting, though, you know, last summer, these schools, they voted to cut officers from their campuses, and they actually lost district dollars because of that. This time around, if you vote no, you can still keep that money. You just got to figure out where else you're going to spend that money. The question is, where else are you going to spend that money if not for these resource officers?
An art teacher. What changes more lives than another teacher in the classroom? A good one that can inspire kids. I mean, I grew up in Downers Grove. We had a couple of school officers. I think my mom, who was a teacher at Downers Grove South, broke up more fights than the school resource officers did. Right. I mean, you can have police officers nearby the school drive around, but for $50,000 extra bucks, if you can, and this is what your school chooses to do, have another band director. I don't know. Like, that's going to change more people's lives, I feel like, than a guy roaming or gal roaming the hallways for the occasional kerfuffle that happens in the school. What do they really do? I mean, I'm sure there's examples where they've helped out in a fight or a serious situation, of course, but I think they're fewer and far between than maybe we let ourselves on to believe.
Well, but I also wonder if the presence of the officer is what taps it down. They might just be there to, like Eric said, put them in the criminal justice system quicker than they would otherwise be. And maybe a record is not the best thing to give the kid at school. That was Steve Bertrand's point, our former rascal. He said, the problem is you introduce kids into the criminal justice system quicker than you would otherwise. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
Well, yeah, it goes to that school to prison pipeline that we talk about. And that's the earliest way and easiest way to get them in there. That's really the big question for these schools. Does having the resource officer there actually provide a resource? Does it help any situation? Does it prevent dangerous situations? Truth is, fights are going to happen in high school for the stupidest things. You know, I was a guy. I'm not going to say I was in the fights, but, you know, I may have.
I'll say it. You weren't in the fights, Brandon.
The statute of limitations has run on whatever fights you were in.
I may have agitated a few. That's all. You know, I may have, you know. Raise, but that's what kids do. So I like the point John made earlier. I didn't think about that. Take that money, if they're allowed to, give it to a different position, an art teacher, another position where you could actually have that. Maybe another counselor.
The money is curious to me because $50,000 is not enough to pay a Chicago police officer. That's not, the police officers make more than that. I don't know how much more, but what do they make? 70, 80, 90, something like that.
Yeah.
So that and with benefits, it doesn't seem like $50,000 quite covers that. So I don't even understand the math here.
Entry level teachers at CPS make more than that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so you're not going to be able to buy a new art teacher for $50,000 either. So it seems to me like this is something that must have been studied pretty carefully at some point, and that Austin must have written about it in his book.
Yeah,
we didn't write about SROs, but something to keep in mind is that there are a lot of teachers that do feel the need, like not everybody's like Mrs. Hansen, like badass roaming around, breaking up fights. And there's a lot of teachers who don't want to be put in that position where, like, there are plenty of schools in Chicago where there's fights every day, like that are potentially violent. And there should be someone there to protect not only students, but also like employees of the school from having to break up stuff like that. And so a lot of teachers are like, no, I would prefer to have this person here. The question is, when you're putting someone from the Chicago Police Department into a school, they have lots of other directives, and you get weird stuff like, you know, searching kids' social media profiles and like all this law enforcement activity that's not necessarily like just purely a school safety activity. So you just need a lot more guardrails around the program, I think.
Speaking of how we police the schools, a real hot topic on the radio this week and on social media, and it's going to get only more and more heated, is should the kids wear masks when they go back to school in the fall? And I heard from a school board member today, and she said, wow, this is a nightmare all over again. The Barrington School Board met this week, and they had to gavel the meeting shut a couple of times just to quiet everybody down. And ultimately, they decided against the CDC guidelines, which said that people that aren't vaccinated, students, should be wearing the mask and socially distancing. That's just the rule from the CDC. The state guidelines are a little muddier on that, although I thought they were going to follow that. But in Barrington, here's the solution. Sixth grade on up, you don't have to wear a mask, even if you're not vaccinated. Of course, if you were vaccinated, you wouldn't have to wear a mask. They could have ruled that way. But they're saying some kids aren't vaccinated. A lot of sixth graders won't be, and they don't have to wear the masks either. And that's the compromise that their school board came up with.
I was driving through Indiana yesterday, stopped at a gas station there, a gas station I actually stop at quite a bit as I go back and forth to Ann Arbor, and usually when I stop there, just about everyone, all the customers are wearing masks. Yesterday, I would say 10% of the customers were wearing masks. This is a big mini mart, McDonald's rest stop area. And I just thought, I saw that and said, we are doomed. I mean, we are really doomed. that people are so over COVID-19 right now. They don't want to wear masks. They don't want to distance. They want.
Were you wearing a mask?
Oh, yeah, of
Why?
Course.
Why? You've been vaccinated.
I've said this before. I wear a mask as a social signifier. The fact that I'm still taking this seriously and that we should all be taking it.
Okay, but you're an outlier. You're an outlier on that, Eric. I don't wear a mask in that situation, and I've been just as vaccinated as you. I'm not criticizing you, but I'm just saying I don't know that it's fair to judge how bad things are in Indiana because you didn't see people wearing masks at the gas station.
Well, things have changed just in the past month is my observation. I've been to that same station a few times in the past month, and it is things are, I think, dramatically changing. And people are just – they're over it. You can just tell. People are they're just past it. And if you're in a situation like that, yeah, there's still a minimal chance, very small chance, that you could get infected even if you're vaccinated. And that it's one of those things that I think you need to let people know that this is still something to be concerned about, and that they should get, if they haven't been vaccinated, they should get vaccinated. If they know people who haven't been vaccinated, they need to tell them about that. They need to remind them that 99% of the people who are hospitalized and dying from COVID-19 are unvaccinated people. I mean, this is information that we can't just say that's over. That was 2020 and it's 2021 now.
It's the continuing politicization of the school board system, right? And I think that we have this notion that all people that are in school boards are just that parent that wants to help out. They love their kids' education and they're doing it for free, and that's what it is. But the reality is so many people use school boards as the launching path for a career in politics or to get more involved. So it's a political issue. And it drives me crazy. I appreciate the right of the school district to choose their own thing. That's the people that they voted on. That's the vote that they've taken. And that's fine. But it just continues to show that whether it's this or we don't have to talk about critical race theory, but like these school board meetings are becoming some of the biggest theatrics you'll see in politics these days. And they're the most impactful because they make everyday decisions that impact people incredibly, more than national decisions sometimes.
What is the argument about not having children wear masks, high school students wear masks, like, say, in the hallways? Or
it's annoying. I don't know. I can't make their argument for them. Like, I don't get what it is. It's you're teaching our kids they shouldn't have to do it. Kids don't get it. Kids don't spread it. What are the odds? You can tell how I feel about it. It's mind-boggling.
No, but that is true. The chances of a child dying. There's a very interesting piece in New York Magazine about this week, and it was from a guy who went to the University of Chicago. And he said that your child has a better chance of dying of the flu or drowning than dying from COVID-19. The kids don't get it. When they do, they don't suffer that much. And the chance they'll spread it to the adult is going away because the adults have all been vaccinated. He described it as vanishingly slim.
So, John, I want these high school students in Barrington to wear floaties on their arms as well as masks.
That piece is really good. It's called The Kids Are All Right.
Yep.
And And it's important to remember the reason for masks in the schools all along was less for the safety of the kids, and it was more for the school staff, teachers, and support staff. And now that those people have had access to vaccines for months in Illinois, and community spread is low in a lot of areas of Illinois, I think it's much more reasonable now to have school districts saying it's optional, feel free to send your kids to school in a mask or not. Because I do think, now, is it going to ruin a kid's life to have to wear a mask at school? No, probably not. But I do think there's some legit concerns about like social emotional learning and interacting with other people when your face is masked. Now, the whole stuff about like, oh, there's carbon dioxide in the mask and the masks are filthy and like it's actually hurting kids, that stuff's off the deep end, nuts, crazy. But I don't think it's such an extreme position right now to take. And to the politicization point, it's weird on this issue. There's actually cross political alignment. Like there's a lot of center left parents, I think, that got engaged in school and education issues on this specifically and find themselves like aligning with more, you know, Trumpy people.
It's one of those things. Cases are going up, not exponentially, but cases are going up in Illinois and around the country. Florida is a mess.
Missouri.
I still don't know much about this Delta variant. I just get this fear that, yes, we're seeing, you know, we're seeing the light in a sense, but we're taking two steps forward and then we're going to take three or four steps back. And that we're going to constantly be in this wavering back and forth. Because in the end, I mean, I'm kind of like Eric. I still wear a mask, even though I've been vaccinated and I've been ready to go, just because I try to communicate that I'm still trying to be safe about things and that we are not out of this thing yet. When it comes to kids wearing them, what does it hurt is really what it comes down to me. And if I'm a kid, I think it's cool to wear a mask. Masks add to your wardrobe, okay? You can mix and match. You can have different designs. You can show off your favorite sports team or favorite anime you watch. Like, if I'm a kid, I would have loved a mask back in the day.
I did have braces all 4 years of high school. That would have been really good. I'm at the point where you guys wear masks. That's great. Wonderful. I don't. I'm like John. I barely ever wear one unless I'm told I have to, which is fine. But I'm kind of at the point with this whole discussion of masks or vaccinations. I'm almost so fed up with it that at this point, I feel like I'm safe. We've told the best way to be safe. And if you aren't, and in cases rise in your county and you get sick, hopefully you're okay. But I can't waste the RAM on my brain on it anymore.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of on you. You can't say you haven't been warned. Hell, we got the lottery rolling out now to try and bribe you to take the damn thing. So if you're getting sick, or unfortunately, if your kid's getting sick, probably won't happen. But if your kid's getting sick, you can't say we didn't warn you.
How close do you think we are to the Zorn solution of forcing everybody, having employers and schools and everybody force people to get vaccinated? Before you go back to an office, before you go to a school, if you're age eligible, you got to be vaccinated. If you're a teacher, you got to be vaccinated. If you work in a hospital, you got to be vaccinated. The sort of the no jab, no job program that I just think it's time. We've given people, we've been holding people's hand for so long. Like, oh, it's okay.
What do you want from this, Eric? I want to be
done with this.
No, but you'll be done with this. You can accomplish that without everybody wearing a mask. You can accomplish that without everybody getting vaccinated.
France is embracing the Zorn solution, so we will see what the results
are. I'm there.
Well, you already got shuffleboard down for your cruise line trip over. So
there you go.
I think what you want is everybody to be safe and go about their lives, and we kind of are, Eric. I think you're stuck on a solution that no longer has a problem.
As Brandon said, the Delta variant is spreading. We're getting more cases now in Illinois than we had before.
Amongst people who are not vaccinated.
Right. And but those people put a strain on the healthcare system. They put a strain on the health insurance system. And we're in the summer. I remember last summer, things kind of started ebbing a little bit. We were like, maybe we're almost through with this. And it just came roaring back in the fall. And we may see that again here. And hoping that we don't need the booster shot. I know there's talk about that this week. But if we're all still okay, all those of us who've been vaccinated are still okay, there's still going to be a lot more death, a lot more suffering, a lot more expense to businesses and got this thing going on at the Olympics right now. The Olympics look like it might be a super spreader event.
Except there won't be many people there to spread it to.
The athletes will all take it back to their home countries.
I love the Zorn solution. I think it'd be great. But we're already seeing situations here, even in Chicago, where people who aren't vaccinated are feeling the penalties of it, in a sense. There's bars you can't get into because you don't have your proof of vaccination or your vaccine card.
Really?
The Say Lounge over in Wrigleyville, big Cubs bar. You can't get in if you're not vaccinated. It's just the rule they established. So, you know, if more places adopt things like that, you know, I was out on a date with a lady. She's unvaccinated and she couldn't get into a place. And I was like, well, suck to suck. You know,
you went on a date with someone not vaccinated, Brandon?
I did. I didn't know she was not vaccinated until we got to the door, though.
When in that relationship or date does it come up? It's not maybe cool to say, hey, you look great, you've been vaccinated, but it comes up at some point.
Before the check.
Fit it casually into the conversation. Like, yeah. So did you have any symptoms after your second shot?
That's how it comes up sometimes is when you start to talk to people and then they go, well, I'm not vaccinated. And you go, oh, crap, you're one of those people I didn't know. Now I got to do a whole mental reset on the person that I'm talking to right now. Northern Illinois University is requiring it for their students, not the faculty and staff. And we all know Loyola Hospital System is requiring it for their staff. I suppose other hospital systems are going to be doing that as well. I want to ask you guys about a couple of interesting court appearances this week. Jussie Smollett was back in town, and we don't even need to talk about that. But Keegan Castile, an Iowa mechanic.
I love talking about Jussie Smollett, but go ahead, move on. It's your podcast.
I didn't think there was anything more to say about Jussie Smollett, except it's fun to play back the Dave Chappelle monologue.
The whole country was up in arms. It was talking about it all the time on the news. And for some reason, African-Americans, we were like oddly quiet. We were so quiet about it. The gay community started accusing African American community of being homophobic for not supporting him. What they didn't understand is that we were supporting him with our silence. Because we understood that this was clearly lying. None of these details added up at all.
It's all about whether this attorney who was involved really early on in the case and had consulted with the brothers who allegedly helped, who allegedly staged this attack with Jussie Smollett, that he had consulted with them. And it just feels to me like this is something that it's up to Jussie Smollett who he wants to represent him. And if this lawyer is compromised or whatever, that ought to be Smollett's decision and not the court's decision. And this is going to drag on and on. There's not another hearing in the case until mid-August or August.
How is this thing still in our lives? How does this exist? How does this still have a breath in the news? It's amazing to me. Okay, well,
never forget that day. That was just the whole situation. I remember John and me were in the same newsroom, and and both me and John, and John's a gay man, I'm a black man, we were both kind of just like looking at each other like, what's going on here? And he's kind of like, is this kind of fishy to you? I'm like, yeah, you know, this is kind of fishy to me. Like, then I felt free to openly just like raise all my suspicions.
I think the craziest thing was a subway when it's 20 below zero at 2 a.m. That's the weirdest part of that story.
Yeah.
It ends quickly if he just finally admits it. Boy, he'd still get credit. We are such a forgiving country when someone comes forward and says, I'm sorry. Here's why I did it. We are like I think we're the most forgiving culture there is out there.
I think
there.
You're right.
And
I was in a bad place. Yeah, I was in a bad place. And
he'd get work again. I mean, it's his own detriment to keep on dragging this out.
I am interested in what Brandon says, too, though, because you felt, you said, Brandon, free to question the veracity or authenticity of what he was saying. As a white guy, I did not. I mean, like, if he said the MAGA guys beat him up and made homophobic and racial remarks, I'm like, boy, I'm not going to call that into question because that's awful. That's terrible. You cannot be in the front of that line if you're me. Maybe you guys could.
Well, I sat back, too. I mean, I did a lot of sitting back.
Coward! Coward, I say!
We said it in the newsroom. We didn't say it in front of microphones.
We didn't go on there like, it's Jussie Smollett thing.
I was quite surprised that it didn't play a bigger role in the state's attorney's race. That it just seemed to wash off Kim Fox's back. I heard from a lot of people, but maybe they weren't voters, or maybe they were not a representative sample. People who are like, what is going on with Kim Fox? What was she doing? And her explanation as to what happened in that case just never really passed the smell test. I don't really think there's a big conspiracy going on. I think that she thought that she was symbolizing to the community that she was not going to direct her resources to these trivial crimes where no one gets hurt. And yet she didn't read the room correctly to realize that people were really upset about how much in the way of resources the Chicago Police Department devoted to trying to find these guys, and how this wealthy entertainer, I mean, forget that he's black and gay. I don't know that that really played that much of a role in this, but it was a wealthy entertainer from out of town comes in and gives our town a bad name by saying this is happening here. And Kim Fox just was like, oh, we'll just let him go. And I did a piece where I looked at a couple from Minnesota came to Chicago and they staged a robbery on themselves in Lower Wacker Drive. And Fox, she made them plead guilty, and I think they agreed to some small amount of community service. It's not a huge crime. You plead guilty, you say, I'm sorry, I messed up, and Kim Fox gets her admission, and then we're done. And so the question was, why did she let him go without saying he did something wrong? Why didn't you just say, look, say you did it, we'll let you go, and you can get back to your show and get back to your career, and no one will remember. Your name will be an answer to a trivia question in 2 years and not on TV news in Chicago every time you walk into town.
Probably because he refuses to admit that a lot of this was BS. I mean, that's really what it probably comes down to, the pride. I had a feeling this was iffy as soon as he was at some club, I think it was the night after, and he was yelling, I'm the gay Tupac. And I'm like, why would you volunteer that? It seemed very grifty and very, you know, trying to capitalize off of something from the jump.
But John, before we derailed your conversation, you were asking us.
I really did. He said, you don't want to talk about this at all. And we totally said, but no, we're going to.
My batteries ran out, Eric. I'm off this podcast now.
He's gonna edit that part right out of the podcast.
No. I want them to
lift.
I want the listeners to know what I deal with. Zorn's always got another angle on every idea I come up with. Okay, so here we go. Keegan Castile, the Iowa mechanic, appeared in court and has been released pending trial. He was charged with something called felony exacerbating the illegal use of weapons or some such thing. Is that a thing? I saw that in print. Maybe somebody miswrote it. But there's some felony gun charges that he was arrested on. The cleaning staff at the W Hotel on Lakeshore Drive noticed that he had a semi-automatic rifle, a .45 caliber pistol, a scope, several rounds of ammunition in his room, and some of it was positioned on the windowsill overlooking Lakeshore Drive, the beach, and the lake below. There is so far no evidence, that we know of anyway, of any plan he had to do harm to anyone. He said he was in town to propose to his girlfriend on the Ferris wheel at Navy Pier, and there was a diamond ring in the room, and later on, in fact, he did propose to this young lady. So did the city make a mistake? And are they going to get sued again? But if I had to pick a mistake, I would make the mistake of arresting the guy and suffering the consequences as a city afterwards, rather than just saying, well, looks like he's not doing anything wrong yet, so we got to let him go. That'd be interesting to see where this story goes. His attorney is saying that David Brown and Lori Lightfoot were just using this as a distraction from the real problems that they can't control, so at least we got this guy.
It's tough because I don't come from a culture where there's an affinity for guns. I would never think to, like, I'm a gun owner legally in the state of Ohio. Like, I have my grandpa's old guns, but I would never think to take them with me on a proposal mission with my girlfriend. So, you know, but also I can't just, it is duplicitous to assume the guy was up to no good, because that type of gun in particular, from what I'm seeing, can be used for hunting, can be used for other things. However, I don't fault the city in this really tense time we're in when it comes to mass shootings, gun violence. We've seen stuff like this in Chicago before. There was a plot, three summers ago, I think the Blackstone Hotel outside Lollapalooza, where they figured out some guy was planning to overlook and shoot up.
It was the Vegas shooter.
The Mandalay Bay.
Had booked rooms.
It was the guy that shot up Mandalay Bay.
Yes, exactly that. So I can understand that fear and being overly sensitive to that. But it's not normal, I don't think, to bring a gun like that with you on a trip.
Here's the thing that puzzles me about this. He's from Iowa. He's going with his girlfriend to Chicago ostensibly to propose to her. And the story is that he didn't know the guns were in his car. He gets to Chicago to unpack the trunk. He discovers that he's got this guns and the scope and all this other ammunition with him. And rather than leave it in the car where it could get stolen, he takes it up to his hotel room. That doesn't really make sense, because when you're loading the car, you're putting your suitcase in the trunk, you don't say, oh, well, there is my high-powered rifle.
I believe it, Eric. Are you kidding? I could easily see that happening. You throw things in the back
seat. Remember how nervous you were before you proposed? Like, that was probably all that was on his mind.
Okay. All right. So then he gets there. Then you think if you had your weapons in the room, you would like put it under the bed, because the housekeepers are going to come in. Right. That also doesn't make any sense either. In some ways that suggests that he was innocent, because if you're going to do a shooting from a window at a hotel, you're going to want to hide things. And knowing that the housekeeper is going to come in, you're going to want to put things under the bed or not let the housekeeper in, put the little tag on the door saying, do not disturb.
I think we should give credit to the housemaid. No matter what CPD did, maids are now trained. Housekeepers are trained for this sort of thing. We saw the same thing happen at the All-Star game right beforehand too. And I didn't know that was part of housekeeping training now, but I'm glad it is. I mean, these are the little things that are going to stop something that happened to Mandalay Bay from happening again. And if he broke a law and the police arrested him, I mean, how many times do we see that? Police arrest someone for something, a law that they break, just to keep them and question them for longer, you know, an appropriate amount of time to make sure everything's okay. I'd rather a city in this scenario do exactly what happened as opposed to waiting and see what happens.
It is chilling to remember how bad Mandalay Bay was 4 years ago. Over 60 people killed. Over 800 people injured. Austin, you know what bothers me about this story a little bit is I'm kind of believing the guy's story. Like, yeah, I think he's a knucklehead from Iowa.
I think it's a comedy of air, like similar to Brandon's like Curb Your Enthusiasm moment with this lady at the bar they were going to. Like, this guy seems like such a knucklehead. And it reminds me, honestly, we were talking last week about the Rittenhouse trial, where it's like you've got these people kind of LARPing as law enforcement officers, and they've got all sorts of weapons and ammunition, and they're just really irresponsible gun owners. And they make everybody else, they make Brandon with his grandpa's guns in Ohio look bad, or legislation come that targets those people. Like, how more irresponsible could you get to just leave something like that out in your hotel room where you know someone else is going to be coming in? Like, it's just, so it's really hard. It's hard when, law enforcement isn't there to enforce like people's stupid mistakes, but it's really hard to fault the city for kind of having that response at the end of the day.
I don't think they have a lawsuit. Do you? I don't, it was a perfectly, he did break some laws by having those guns in the city, and it was a legitimate arrest. I suppose you might sue the mayor for exaggerating the threat, but I don't think that's
what you call them, weapons of war or something like that. You know what bothered me too, Brandon, was the attorney who sounded pretty slick on this, right? Like he's talk about loaded for bear. Like, if you want to defend your guy, that's fine. But don't say that the mayor and the police chief are using this guy as a scapegoat for all the things they can't control, because they weren't doing that. And it's bad enough as it is. You don't need to pile on anymore. But
it'd be a bad scapegoat.
Yeah, a terrible scapegoat.
This is a completely different thing than what we see, you know, in the neighborhoods of Chicago. So even if they wanted to make an escape, that'd be like, bad strategy. What? I'm like, come on. It's incongruous completely. And so, yeah, I think that was a reach for sure. I get why the city reacted the way they did. I'm happy they did, because who knows? I would hate to think. I go to Oak Street Beach. I live near Oak Street Beach. You gotta be cautious. We have crazy people out here who do crazy things. So we're on high alert. We're a major city, and people in the Midwest see us, especially the, you know, conservative media. They, you know, get people to really have this animosity towards Chicago. And a lot of that is racial animosity in Chicago toward Chicago. I can understand the need for caution and taking whatever precautions you can to make sure nothing tragic ends up happening.
Yeah.
Like you said, Vegas, it's still vivid in my mind. And we're still seeing mass shootings all the time. You got to be sensitive and careful.
At least it was nice to see somebody from out of state come into downtown Chicago willing to spend some money. I mean, granted, he brought a scope and a high-powered rifle, but at least he was willing to come into our town.
The economy's bad.
I can understand why somebody coming from outside Chicagoland who's only heard the bad news thinks, okay, I got to be careful. And if this guy's a gun-carrying guy, at least the 45 makes sense. He thinks he's going to protect himself.
That's a big gun, though. What's he going to? Walk around Mag Mile? How can that be? You have like an AK or something, or it's
he's going to Rittenhouse the Mag Mile. He's just going to patrol it, just make sure things are good.
This man walked into Starbucks Roastery with a whole rifle in his hand. Like, come on now.
I like that coinage of Rittenhousing as a verb.
Yes. That punk doesn't deserve it. Speaking of Lakeshore Drive, the experience of a reporter in the Tribune who wrote about a car crash was a 3-car crash. 10 people were hurt and 4 of them were kids. It was a bad crash the other day, some of them critically injured. And so she described in her reporting of the story in the paper the full name, the full 7-word name, Jean Plant, Lakeshore Drive, DuSable, all that. So she described that as the road and then later tweeted out that she got 17 email about that. All of them were giving her grief about the name of the road and the way she wrote it. She didn't say DuSable Lakeshore Drive. DuSable, she said the whole thing, which I think as a print journalist, you would feel obliged to do, right? That is the name of the road.
You do that, John. You say O'Hare International Airport, even though nobody actually says that. People say, I'm going to O'Hare.
In print, yeah.
You in print. So in print, you use the full name like that. And I was surprised to see, it was Catherine Rosenberg Douglas, my former colleague. And she took a lot of grief for using the name. And I wonder if that change is going to take effect, or how slowly or quickly it's going to take effect. I haven't been listening to the traffic reports. Are the traffic reporters using the full?
They say DuSable Lakeshore Drive.
Yeah,
they
Channel 9, WGN Radio, a lot of them are doing that. They're abbreviating it, which I think that's the compromise the city council should have come to.
Yeah, we don't say Butch O'Hare Field or whatever his full name is. So, yeah, I mean, that would make some sense to say DuSable Lakeshore Drive. That's not a huge mouthful.
And it's also honoring, if we've got to honor this guy, there you go. We said DuSable. But I think the 3 other words remind people that it's Lakeshore Drive. I think you hear Lakeshore Drive as much as you hear DuSable when you do that. She put the whole thing in print. And then people attack her as though she's taking a side. And
I'm
that's
trying to imagine the person that sits down to type an email.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah. Well, John, you and I know they're out there.
Yes.
Eric, you wanted to talk about the Cook County Clerk, Karen Yarborough, speaking of certain sensitivities. Can you kind of catch us up on this story this week?
Well, the Sun-Times, Karen Yarborough was thinking of holding back the property tax bills until this problem, some wrinkles with the senior exemption get worked out. And the Sun-Times wrote an editorial that began, do we really need Cook County Clerk Karen Yarborough to throw a monkey wrench into the delivery of property bills that normally would be due August 1st? And Yarborough took great offense to the term monkey wrench, which you know, it is... She felt that it invoked a racial stereotype and complained about it. The Sun-Times said they had no intention of any racial connotation, but they deleted the word monkey from the editorial. It turns out that the etymology of monkey wrench is unclear, that it may be related to a person named Monk, M-O-N-K, who invented or perfected this particular kind of wrench, or it may be a misunderstanding of something that was called a non-key wrench. But no one is clear. And some people say that it was because the jaws of the wrench, it's one of these, it's like a pipe wrench, kind of is what it looks like, reminds some early users of a monkey because of its long tail. But in any case, given the etymology, it was clearly a clumsy use of the term, because you could just say throw a wrench into something, right? I mean, that's a fairly common thing. And it was just one of those inadvertent errors that I think the Sun-Times made. I think you just don't. You have to be very careful with the language that you use. And Yarbrough took exception. I think she may have overplayed how offended she truly was, given that the Sun-Times is not a paper. The editorial board of Sun-Times certainly not people you would expect to be, you know, putting racial dog whistles into their editorials. It was a mistake. They changed it, and I think all's well that ends well. But it was. I thought it was one of those really interesting moments in language usage that you just got to be a little careful when you're writing about everything. But when you're using terms like that, you got to say, well, you know, could anybody misunderstand that? Is there any reason why we maybe would want to be careful with our language here?
It reminds me of a guy at ESPN. You guys may remember this story. He was a SportsCenter anchor, and he was talking about a story that had an Asian American player. I think it was Jeremy Lin for the Knicks. And he used the terminology "a chink in the armor," which is a commonly used phrase when you talk about, you know, chainmail and things like that knights wore in the medieval times. But in the context when you're talking about an Asian American person, people quickly were like, yeah, that's not good. He didn't write the copy, but he got the boot from that copy. Word usage matters. And that's why I think even more so you need diversity in newsrooms to have those checks on things like that. But it's a simple mistake. I don't think it was malicious. And I think you're right, Eric. I think Yarbrough definitely overinflated probably her offense to that. I don't think she read
it. Yeah, don't you think they exacerbate their own injury when they call it into question, particularly when it doesn't appear as though they were trying to be cute? Like in the case of the Jeremy Lin story, do you think that was a pun? Were they kind of winking like, aren't we clever? Do you remember the way that went down, Brandon?
I didn't feel like it was at all. I thought it was
an honest mistake.
Yeah, commonly used sports term to talk about a weakness a player might have. And it didn't even click for me until people explained. I would not
have thought that with Monkey Wrench either. Although, did you guys notice that this week it was announced that they are not going to call the invasive Asian carp Asian carp or invasive Asian carp? They are now going to officially call those four breeds of fish invasive carp so as not to cast a pejorative light on people of Asian heritage, even though those fish came from Asia. That is a proper descriptor of that fish. I also noticed this week that it's just kind of a coincidence, is it, that scientists are no longer going to refer to the gypsy moth as a gypsy moth, because that's seen as a bad thing, even though that's the historic name by which it is commonly known.
I think it's okay for language evolving around things like that, right? Like who was really helped by calling it Asian carp? Like I don't,
right?
Like who cares where the carp came from? Like a virus there, where there was actually like geopolitical implications, like there's maybe more of an argument being like, hey, this came from Wuhan or something. But for things like the monkey wrench and other things like this, where it basically gives, so Karen Yarbrough is going to claim this is the most offensive thing in the world to me, and she's beyond reproach for that. Nobody could tell her really, hey, you're overblowing that, because that was a really stupid move by the Sun-Times. It's basically a gift. And now we're not talking about why it is that you have the Cook County treasurer, the Cook County assessor, and the Cook County clerk somehow all need to have their offices involved in property tax assessment. Like two of those three offices shouldn't even exist. But now we're having to talk about the Sun-Times like use of a word. And when you have the use of this kind of speech or discussion about this evolution of language in a political context, you often see the most savvy political actors use it to avoid accountability for actually talking about things that matter. And that really is, it's a cop-out on a lot of things. And you see Mayor Lightfoot do it sometimes, where she's like, well, a lot of people just criticize me because I'm a Black gay female and they can't handle that. And no one can really challenge her on that. And that should be concerning for anyone who wants accountability from politicians, that they can hide behind this kind of offense.
I hate when she said that, by the way. That was so stupid. It's like, you're telling me the Black people that criticize you, the Black women that criticize you, are criticizing you because you're a Black woman? Shut up.
But people do tend to shrink away when you drop that card, even though it might seem heavy-handed or inappropriate. Again, a lot of the white media, for instance, even those of us who have been in the game for a while, you go, ah, crap, now I'm on my heels. Now I got to fix that or apologize or see if I did something wrong. And now you're not talking about what you should be talking about.
Well, I'm really glad that there's no sense that anyone at the Sun-Times lost their job over this, that people recognize in this case that there's a difference between a mistake where you mean no malice, you mean no harm, and you regret it and you apologize and you move on, and someone who actually tries to slip a slur into an editorial or into a commentary, that intent really does matter. And I think that we really have to remember that as we are holding people to high standards, especially in their terminology, that if someone is going to use a term that gives offense inadvertently, then they need to be told that was offensive and please don't do it again. And they say, okay, we're sorry. And the Sun-Times removed the word from its online editorial and it said it didn't mean any harm. And we've all moved on. But I think that's a good lesson for people when they're offended by a gypsy moth or something, to say, look, the entomologists meant no harm.
Words matter and language matters. But I do feel, and this is, I think, similar to what Austin was saying, is that you – and I hate to bring this is sort of like the Jussie Smollett thing. And now you can't cut it out of the podcast, John, because I brought it back up again. I was most offended by Jussie Smollett because I know people that have been attacked for being gay and for faking it. It casts such a, you know, it almost negates the other attacks. Saying you're super offended, it's the most offensive word of the thing that ever happened, and you keep on using hyperbole for this, takes out real discussions that need to happen about language changes. Not that this one wasn't real. I'm saying in general, if you pull that card too many times, if you blow it up too much, then there's some honest to goodness changes that we need to be make that people just turn off to because they lump it all as cancel culture.
Yeah, because then they just drop back on you. Oh, this is the political, this is the language police or the PC crowd, right. And you don't want to be that, even though in fact, you've got a pretty good point this time. One other thing, not related to that. A lot of people, I'm reading from John Hansen's note to us, including Chris Bryant's father, are pissed that Joe Buck asked him during their losing streak if he's staying with the Cubs or not. I missed that. So it was on the national broadcast?
I wrote the note wrong, John. He said it during the All-Star game. He interviewed him.
Okay, yeah.
But he asked him about the losing streak. And so Chris Bryant was wearing a mic on the field, right? It's like this whole way of them trying to interact with people more as the game is happening. Every discussion about Chris Bryant now is, where is he going to go? He agrees to wear a microphone on the field. You don't think he knew he was going to get that question? These people get so much love from press. This is how they make their millions. And for his dad and many other people, a lot of Cubs fans I've been reading on Twitter saying, how dare you ask Chris Bryant that during the All-Star game? Like, what are we talking about?
So then Chris Bryant's dad is on some sort of social media or other platform saying that was inappropriate to put my son in that position?
I think so, yeah. Or he was quoted in an article and that was spread on social media,
Is it responsible for the Cubs to keep Chris Bryant and Javi Baez and all these guys whose contracts are running out at the end? Was the end of this year? Or
yeah,
this year?
Bryant's at the end of this year.
And I mean, this team is going nowhere fast. And it's time to say thanks for 2016, but we're going to start rebuilding now.
I think they're going nowhere real fast, but.
Well, a smart front office, once you have a player that has interest like Chris Bryant, the Phillies, the Mets, the Sox, both Sox, the Red Sox and the White Sox, you have people that would really like to have Chris Bryant on the team. You know your team is not going anywhere. You could use a nice little rebuild. You got to strike the iron when it's hot, you know?
But baseball's changed a little bit in the last few years. You don't get as much for these rental players as you used to. You used to get top-loaded prospects. Now teams are a lot closer to the guard about what they're going to give you, and there's draft implications, too, that with this. So,
well, then 2 weeks ago, we weren't going to have this conversation anyway because I had tickets to my Subway Series. I had the Sox. the Cubs were hot, and people like me were just saying, hey, what do you know? Maybe everybody's wrong. The Cubs could be in the playoffs. The White Sox are going to be in the playoffs. Yeah,
they just no-hit the Dodgers.
That was, for 2 weeks ago. And then they've lost 13 out of 15 games or whatever it was going into the All-Star break. And, I'd break up that team. I'd get what I could for any of them.
Well, John, I was glad I was filling in for you then the week the losing streak started, because I wasn't saying that. So
you were
your
not,
listeners were properly prepared for the fall.
You knew it was coming. You knew that when the Cubs were winning that that wasn't going to last, John?
Yes, they were winning. I think the best thing to do in baseball is look at how many one-run games a team is in. And if they are winning far more than they should be, that usually means the pendulum has swung one way too far. And the Cubs were winning one-run games at some crazy clip, and they were getting a lot of lucky bounces along the way. And it's a 162-game season, and around July 1st is when you can start to tell, and that's where they showed us who they were.
And what about Rizzo? He's a little bit longer, right?
No, he's also going to be a decision here this year, as far as I remember. But I don't know. He's a franchise player, I guess you could say. I mean, I guess they all are in certain different ways. He's a fan favorite. I think Rizzo stays, if that were my guess, and Bryant and Baez would go.
Of all of the guys on that team in 2016, who is the one who you enjoyed the most?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Schwarber for me. And he
didn't
even
play
much
until the World Series.
I know. He was there for about 10 minutes in the beginning of the season, and then he had that run at the end. But then I liked him in 2017 because we got to see a little bit more of him. And, boy, I'd like it if he was on the team this year because he tied a major league record for home runs.
I love watching Dexter Fowler because he would get on base to start almost every single game with the Cubs. There was some crazy stat that they were like 50-9 when he got on base to start a baseball game, which is crazy. He led off game 7 with that home run. Ooh, you're taking me back, John.
Austin, which of those players did you like the most?
Stop.
I know you're a Cardinal fan, but just which was Dexter your favorite?
Dexter Fowler is especially offensive because the Cardinals bought him off that great season. He totally stunk.
Yeah.
I always was John Lester on the 2016 roster.
Oh yeah,
he's the only, I genuinely like John Lester as a baseball player, independent of his status as a Chicago.
I don't remember exactly how well Baez did in 2016, Javi Baez, but boy, is he an incredible player. Just in my memories of him in the last few years, anyway, and the kinds of plays that he makes, the kind of hustle that he shows, the kind of attitude he brings to the ballpark. He is just an amazing player, and he ought to be the franchise face of that team.
Baez stole home in game 1 of the NLCS against the Dodgers and electrified the crowd.
And he stole first in that one game this year. One of the greatest base running plays in the history of the game.
So good.
How about you, Brandon?
Or one of the worst defensive plays in the history. Yeah, of the game.
Worst defensive plays. Yeah, yeah.
But you don't think that they could get some really hot prospects for a team going down in the pennant stretch to give them a Javi Baez or a?
Well, the other owners are as smart as Cubs owners are, right? Like, I mean, there's a reason why they're not re-signing these guys. They're at a certain age, and they are very inconsistent offensive talent. Even Chris Bryant, who started the year gangbusters, has cooled down so incredibly. A little bit better the last week or two before the All-Star break. Javi Baez strikes out at an incredible clip. But yes, he brings such an energy, but I don't know if you're selling your future. I think that's more it. I don't think it's that the talent isn't there to trade off for it. I think teams are just more aware of, hey, the key to winning World Series now is not to go for it for 1 year, but to have a window open for as long as possible. And by selling top-tier prospects, you close your own window faster. Like with Aroldis Chapman, when the Cubs got him in 2016, giving up so many young talented players. Jose Quintana in 2017, same sort of thing. You really close your window quickly. And I just don't think teams are as willing to do that now.
But the windows do close, and when you're a team that's having a good season, like the White Sox are having a good season, they've got all these injured players, and I'm sure that their front office is thinking, God, we just need a couple more pieces to fill in for these injured guys, and we got the best record in the AL right now. We're going to take this to the pennant. We're going to take it to the World Series. And next year, everything can fall apart. Contracts are short, and people get injured and all this other stuff. So that another school of thought is we've got to strike while the iron is hot. While we've got a team that's on fire, while we've got a team that's clicking, we bring in some new pieces, we win the World Series, and then the next year we suck again. But only one team can win the World Series every year. So.
Well, the White Sox have one of the charts graphs going the wrong way. The more players get injured, the more games they win. Those should be intersecting at some point, but they seem to be impervious to their injuries.
I'd like to hear John Hansen's analysis of that. It doesn't make any sense. It's like the Cubs winning one-run games.
How if the Sox were to play 100 more like this, I think they'd lose more than they'd win, at least in the last, you know, or the first 80 games. I think that they have a little luck on their side. They had a soft spot in the schedule leading into they're going to start the All-Star break afterwards here with a much different schedule here. But man, they're a good team, and this is why you want deep teams. This is why you want guys in the minors that you can bring up. I mean, when you think about baseball in the long haul, yes, there are these players that are incredible players, but you look at their wins above replacement or what they would be versus an average player. In a given year, someone that has a 4 or a 5, that's a really good year. You need a bunch of those guys to be able to do that. So it's not that the star power isn't important. It's just that I think teams like recognize that you, the deeper your bench is, the deeper your team is, the more of those guys that are above average as opposed to one stellar guy makes all the difference. I think that they've just got a really deep pitching situation too with the White Sox.
Yeah.
But they should buy. I agree. They should go for Chris Bryant. I think the city would burn, but.
What? How is no one saying the magic of Tony La Russa is why this has happened? The 2006 Cardinals, I think, are still the worst team to ever win the World Series, and he's magic. The worse the players, the better.
Is that the science? Is that what it is?
The Mincing Rascals gives you sports analysis you don't get anywhere else.
I'm kind of surprised at how well we did it, to be honest with you. So,
should we go to women's softball next again?
I think we should cut our losses now and wrap this bad boy up. John Hansen, thanks for jumping in here with us today. And Brandon, we always appreciate you being part of the Mincing Rascals, too.
Thank you. Love to be with you guys. Good times.
Austin Berg, Eric Zorn, I'm John Williams. And we're produced by this week Ashley Byhun and Curtis Koch. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. Okay, Eric, I wrapped it up there. Is that okay?
That's fine. That was good. We went for about an hour, right?
Yeah. We'll get about an hour out of that.
Great.
Hey, thanks, right, fellas. I appreciate your patience, peace, too. Bye now.
Have a good one.
Thanks, guys.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.